Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Hustle. It's John Lamoureux. Okay, our guest this week is guitarist Hugh Gower. Now, Hugh, among many, many other things, was the original guitarist in the band The Records. And The Records were one of those kind of skinny-tie power pop bands that came out in the late 70s. In fact, he was only really around for their first album, Shades in Bed, from 1979, that featured this song right here, Starry Eyes, which is still, it was kind of a hit then, and it's still sort of a cult classic now. If you know The Records, this is probably the tune you know the most. Well, after one album, he bailed. It wasn't really his scene anymore. But he went on to start working with and playing with people like David Johansen, Graham Parker, among a bunch of other people. He's also done a lot of solo material of his own that I would urge you to check out. In fact, I actually like the solo material better than The Records, but The Records music, I should say. But anyway, yeah, I really like what he's done. And now it's really interesting because his career is not what you would imagine it being. Now, something I think is really kind of interesting about Hugh and his story is that, I don't know about you, but when I think about those skinny tie new wave bands, I mostly think of American bands. But Hugh and The Records were from the UK. And I was trying to get to the bottom of, like, what is it that you guys are listening to that makes you think of those, those new wave bands that we knew? The bands like The Knack or Rick Springfield or Greg Kinn or whatever. Because I just don't think of those bands as coming from the UK, but they did. So anyway, we talk about the influences and everything else. I will tell you, I had mentioned before that there were a couple of interviews that I did where the technology was horrible. It really failed us that day, and this was the other one. Because of that, it just makes for a very disjointed conversation when you don't know, when half the time the sound is cutting out and you don't know if it's going to continue or what. And so this conversation is not quite as great as I would have normally liked, and it was largely because of the technology conflicts we were having. So I hope you'll bear with us. I hope, if nothing, Jan, of course, fixes all of it so perfectly, as he always does. And more than anything, I hope you hear some music that you like. But if it's disjointed in any way, that's why. Okay? Hugh called me from his home in New York City. Well, thanks a lot for doing this with me. How are you holding up out there? How's the quarantining going?
Well, we have a nice place, I'm doing some virtual, online work. That's been going quite well, actually, I think. People really like it.
Good. First and foremost, I've been listening to The Records for a while, and it kind of comes as a surprise to me that you guys were a British band, because to me, that's your brand of new wave power pop sound of that era sounds so American to me. It sounds just like The Knack or Shoes, the band Shoes, which you probably, maybe mm-hmm. you know that or maybe you don't. You guys sound a lot like Shoes.
Yeah, so that was kind of like the era that we were around.
Yeah, but those are very American bands. And so I'm curious, I have a real affection and affinity for British alternative, the Two-Tone, the Smiths, your era. So who were you listening to that was inspiring the sound of The Records?
Well, I joined the band. I didn't have the blueprint of the band per se, but I was introduced to the second Big Star album around that time. That's I thought to myself, that's probably one direction to go. But I mean, my tastes in American bands were from the late 60s, Love particularly, Spirit, and I was perhaps putting some of that. But then, you know, I grew up with the Beatles and the Stones. So, you know, they obviously were, as a very young kid trying to figure out how to play the guitar, some of those records were quite instrumental, I suppose, simply because, you know, you listen to records to learn from. So kind of worked it out with your friends, which I think is quite typical of a lot of British musicians of you know, who grew up who were kids in the 60s, and then, you know, later on I listened to the early Grateful Dead. I mean, you know, they may have involved a certain amount of psychedelic experimentation. Well, may it did. And I'm old.
Yeah, right.
I also like some of the early Steve Miller records too. I call it just sort of like pop blues, really, I suppose, in many respects, you know?
Yeah.
You know, white guys trying to sound black, and sometimes not even achieving that, but it doesn't really matter.
Well, it's interesting to me. I mean, over here, you know this, in the States, big star were obscure. So how
absolutely completely unknown, yeah, right.
Yeah, so how does a Brit, you know, find that album? Were you on an island by yourself? Did you have friends that were really into Big Star as well?
No, that was I was when I joined the band. I was given a cassette with some songs to indicate the sonic direction, I suppose you could call it, that those guys wanted to go in. So I did my homework, and you know, but I was sort of thinking to myself, well, the Birds were doing it as well, you know. If I can just sort of go forward a little bit, a lot of people think that the lead guitar on Starry Eyes is a 12-string. It's not.
Yeah.
It's actually a 6-string. You know, I'm playing it a particular way. But I was also listening to a load of R&B as well, you know, and I still do. I mean, I listen to everything Sunday White said rather fortuitously. Only two kinds of music, good or bad.
Yeah.
And it's all very much a question of taste, I suppose, but, you know.
Right. So I'm curious what those...
Good enough answer for you, but...
No, that's great. I am curious, when you were coming up in, I don't know, British pubs or whatever you were doing, who were some of the bands that you were kind of hobnobbing with? Because like I said, I always imagine either Two Tone or early New Wave. So we're talking like the Specials or Ultravox or something like that. Those are the bands that are Spandau Ballet. Those are the bands that I'm imagining in all the clubs, but you don't have that sound. So who are you hobnobbing with back then?
Women? No.
Yes. Of course, you're rock stars.
I started playing when I was 12 years old. By the time I joined the records, I was... you know, not quite twice or so, but at least 10 or so more years older. And so, you know, I mean, I've been in band, you know, other bands that I've helped form and so forth, psychedelic bands, again, something like pop blues bands and so forth. So, you know, I mean, I was hanging out with my friends, had a really nice fun band called the Fabulous Rat Bites from Hell, which also included the future lead guitarist of The Only Ones, John Perry, who we're still friends, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's a question of who you admire, and honest with you, I wasn't listening to much punk rock because I thought most of it was a load of shit. Mm-hmm. I did, however, think the Two Tone stuff was excellent, but that was kind of, you know, I left England in 81, so when the synthesizers came in, I kind of left England to get away from them. Well, they followed me across the Atlantic, of course, and, you know, some people make some very good sounds on that. You know, I mean, just sidebar here, one of my bands, The Dragons, the keyboard player was a very young Alan Wilder who went on to be very, very successful in Depeche Mode. So,
Wow, that's wild.
But we weren't playing anything like that.
I mean, yeah.
Those kinds of machines were still sort of in their infancy, I suppose, really. You know?
Sure.
I didn't care much for English prog rock. I didn't give much about, you know, one song every now and then. But, you know, I thought The Clash had a couple of good tunes, and the Sex Pistols had three great records.
Yeah.
But I wasn't hanging out with them.
Yeah.
I did find out later on, was that I thought I was older than they were. I was actually younger than some of them.
Really?
So it was a bit of, I'm just trying to sort of put a finger on it. I thought Rock Pile were pretty good, actually.
Yeah, okay, I can see that. Yeah, okay, yeah. That makes some sense. I'm trying to think of British bands of that era that I might compare you to. And Yeah, Rockpile or Brinsley Schwartz or maybe even Dr. Feelgood a little bit, I don't know, kind of in a, but you guys just have such a, to me anyway, such an American sound. And
Yeah, I think that was the plan. I mean, that was the blueprint that it was to try and make a band in your country, or it was my adopted country now. That's fairly measured attempt, I suppose. So you have to remember, John, that, I mean, we're talking nearly 40 years ago now. A lot, a lot. I've done a lot more since then. Which, I mean, I'm very glad that I was able to work with Starry Eyes. I did write the guitar solo, which they never gave me credit for. But that's again a bit of a sidebar. So, I mean, I was out of the band by the end of the 70s.
Now, so let's put a pin in that because I want to ask you more about that. So when the first album comes out and the it's Shades and Bed and Starry Eyes is making some headway, and I am curious, how your life changes. I'm guessing you go on some kind of a tour. What kind of bands are you opening up for? What are some of the, are you seeing America for the first time? Is it kind of blowing your mind? You're probably seeing the world, let alone America.
I'd seen a bit of the world before when I was a kid, but as part of a Stiff Records thing, Be Stiff, whatever it was, we played 4 nights at the Bottom Line at the end of 1978 over the Christmas Jewish holiday period, and that's where Starry Eyes took off in a sense, because literally sort of four or five DJs from the then. Remember when radio guys could play the songs they wanted to play? They were hanging out with us backstage, and well, everybody else too. The next day it starts to go on the radio, on FM, But back in England, we never headlined. Well, we did the pub things. We did the Hope and Anchor and the Greyhound, and a lot of, I think the Hope is still actually going. But the tours we did, I suppose the most significant one was to promote Shades and Bell. We toured with The Jam for about 6 weeks,
Oh, nice.
which was a nice mix, actually. I thought, us and them.
I could see that. That makes a lot of
Yeah.
sense. So what, I'm curious what the second single off of that album was. What, I assume Starry Eyes was the first one. What did they follow that up with?
A very horrible song in my mind called Teen-O-Rama. Because lyrically, it's like, really? I mean, at the time, I just wasn't really thinking it through. But yeah, and of course, it just did nothing, And Starry Eyes did nothing in England. It was never a hit or even get any much radio play at all there. So the English follow up to it was Rock and Roll Love Letter, which we did an okay version of, I suppose. But that failed as well. Teen-O-Rama was the third single in England, and it did about as well. So. And it was pretty much all over after that, I suppose. For me, I mean, they went on and did a couple more records, but I wasn't anything to do with it. Although, I mean, I did some work on some of the songs that ultimately appeared on, I think, the second record, I guess.
Well, before we move off of this first one, I got to tell you, I really like your song, The Phone.
Know it's there if ever I'm lonely.
can call up anywhere.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I do. I like it a lot. And, you know, it's interesting. Maybe this is unfair of me to say. I actually prefer the phone and, like, Guitarophilia and the stuff you were coming up with. I actually like your sound better. And I'm not just saying that because I have you on the phone here, but it's because I just find there are more shades, more... layers. It's a little more interesting to me. First of all, your voice sounds a lot, maybe you've heard this, you sound a lot like Andy Partridge from XTC.
Well, we're both from the West Country, yes.
Really? So I love XTC a lot too. And so I hear this real connection with an XTC, a band I already like, and a voice that's very similar. And I just find the songs that you're coming up with more interesting, I guess, than the record. So I'm wondering if you felt that way too, and that's what led you to move past the records. Why did you leave?
Well, they kicked me out, actually.
Really? Are you hard to work with or something?
Yeah, I guess I am. No, I mean, I have certain standards, and I felt that the lead singer was in the studio. You can do any number of things. And still going on to this day with pitch correcting and all that crap, you know?
Yeah.
But I felt that we weren't that good live. And the guy had no idea as to how to routine a song vocally, looking back on it. None of us did. We're very inexperienced in that regard.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I remember once we worked with the Cars, and I was really impressed at their vocal blend. I mean, I don't particularly care for the group, but, you know, you can just recognize, you know, a really good unit. And, I think 4 out of 5 of them were saying, you know, so.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was kind of getting to me too. And also the management was terrible. Mm. We were off. I mean, this is perhaps it wasn't a turning point, but it was certainly towards the end. For example, we were offered a Christmas Eve show at the biggest venue in London at the time, which was the Hammersmith Odeon.
Okay.
Opening for Paul McCartney and Wings.
Whoa. Oh, wow.
Right. Well, okay. The guys whose band it actually was said, nah, we don't want to do that.
What?
So that would have, you know, been nice. As it turns out, I've become very good friends with the drummer of that band at the time, Steve Holly. And,
yeah.
So he's in New York too. So we're in touch quite a lot.
Huh.
But yeah, I mean, it was just like, it just didn't seem to be being thought through. And
yeah.
I think that there was some pushback because of perhaps I was bringing too much. God, I'm trying to sound not too conceited here, but I mean, Will Birch, whose band it basically was, once said in an interview that I was the only real musician in the band. Well, after a while, it gets old when, you know, I mean, I couldn't jam with those guys.
Yeah.
It was, you played the song, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't like, well, let's just play something, you know, pick a key, and then, well, and we'll just look at me with eyes askance going, huh?
Yeah, they weren't really trained that way. Yeah.
So they were just framed differently in that respect, I suppose. So, and I can be quite restless in some respects. And I do get a little bit bored. But I was also trying to improve the situation. And I wasn't being respected from my points of view, shall we say.
Yeah, okay. So
Yeah.
you leave, and are you immediately replaced, but then by a 19-year-old Jude Cole? Did you know Jude? Did you have a hand in this?
No, I had nothing to do with it. No.
Oh,
But
okay.
the connection was the producer, Craig Leon.
Ah.
I recommended Jude to them because Jude had been in Moon Martin's band. I don't know if you remember them. They had sort of a hit in the late 1970s, too. So I had nothing to do with that. Actually, I thought, he's a pretty good singer. That if they brought him in, then that would have probably taken care of my feelings about the way that the songs are being fronted, should we say, you know?
Yeah. Huh. I had no idea. I like Jude a lot. I have some of his solo stuff. And I just thought, what a wild pairing. I would have never guessed that Jude Cole would join this British, power pop band in the late 70s. That's crazy. Okay. Now, I am curious when you go on, and I know you do a lot of other things, and we're going to touch on those things, but Guitarophilia is just this perfect little snapshot. Four great songs, all of them are solid. Are these songs that, is this like a George Harrison situation where you are trying to introduce these songs to the records and they want no part of it, and so you go solo so that you can get them off your chest and put them out in the world?
Quite an idle answer that one. I wouldn't say I was as prolific as George was, but when I came to New York, I started working with David Johansen, and we
Yeah.
did a live album.
Great album, by the way.
Yes, I liked it too. But
Yeah.
then I started, and I was then beginning really to stockpile some songs, and I was literally made an offer by, just as an independent financier, would you like to make an EP? And I said, yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
So I used three out of the four of the musicians in Johansson's band, and we'd rehearse the songs once and cut them the day after that or something like that. I think maybe we
Yeah.
did it over, but
Okay.
that's about it. I
Well,
think,
I just
She's Still a Mystery came out really well, actually. This is probably my
Yes.
favorite, but Calling Out the Heretics is pretty solid. And
I like all
that
four
wouldn't
of
have
them.
been a That wouldn't have been a lyric that the records would have handled because it's about the Falkland Islands War,
Right,
so.
right. Yeah, when I listen to the EP, I just think, boy, these songs are great. I wonder if they had been sitting around and you were sort of, hoping to get them on a record, and it never happened, so you used them on your own. But yeah, all four of those songs are good. Now, you mentioned David Johansen. I got to ask, how does that even happen? How do you connect up with David Johansen?
Through an ad in the Village Voice.
Really? That
Yes.
shocks me. Well, okay.
That's
I
how
would
I got,
think.
that's how, I mean, same, go back with to the records. I got the job in the records by answering an ad for a guitar player in The Melody Maker, which was
No way.
the Musicians Exchange at that time, yeah.
So you answer an ad in the paper for David, and that's how you get that gig. Wow. Now, how long did you play with David? Because I think the only credit I see is the Live It Up album, which again, as I said, is fantastic. But were you not sticking around long enough to be on one of the studio albums?
Well, I was with him from, I guess, November 81 to August 83. So what's that? It's 18 months, 20
Okay.
months maybe. So the live album, obviously, was essentially a live album. Well, of course, live albums back then, there was a certain amount of sweetening that took place and still does, I'm sure. But, it was recorded live at the Paradise in Boston. I think we did the basic tracks. And it was all very nice for a while. It was, the Animals medley ended up being the top MTV video for October of 82 or whatever.
In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me there ain't no use in trying. Oh, little girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, you're gonna die before your time is due. Receive my daddy.
But it didn't translate, as the record company, I think, had hoped, into, say, Frampton Comes Alive-type record sales. They were looking for the big one, and I think it was more modest than that. So he was with Blue Sky Records, which is Steve Paul's label, Johnny Winter, the Winter Brothers, Dan Hartman, Rick Derringer,
Yep.
Basically, they were affiliated with Epic, Columbia. And Epic dropped the, I don't know if they dropped the whole label, but they didn't want another record from David. And we'd been writing songs, him and I wrote a few songs together, and he was writing with a couple of other members of the band. But there was, but there was little interest from Epic.
Huh.
And at the same time, the phone rang one day, and it was Graham Parker offering me a tour.
Yeah, I love Graham too. Okay,
I was at that point a little bored with doing jazz, because we were working a lot, but we were playing the same songs over and over and over again, and nothing much was really progressing in terms of, let's make a record, that's the only way you get. So we kind of changed direction after that, but I just said, look, David, I got to do something else. So we did.
Okay.
And it was David's record, after all. I had no songs on that record. Although he did eventually record one that we did write together that's on a Buster Poindexter album called This Is the Worst Beer I've Ever Had.
After working all day, I head to the bar. My friends are all there and oh how witty they are. We talk of the events of the day until we invariably say, how dare you treat us this way? Sorry. This is the worst beer that I've ever had. The worst beer that I've ever had. It's so abominably bad, we're turning gay man sad. The worst beer that I've ever had. I've traveled all over the world. I've sipped a porter in every port of call. I've had some porter in Japan, that strange exotic land.
And I can tell you the story behind that.
Please tell it.
I think we were playing like a freshman do up in a college in Connecticut, not long after I joined the band. Maybe it was a bit later than that. Or maybe it was a spring thing or something. And the only thing they brought for us to drink was a keg.
Hmm.
I'm sure you've had some experience of that particular, shall we say, rather inexpensive form of so-called beer. Right. And that was just something I said. I drank one of it. I said, this has to be the worst beer I've ever had. He said, sincerely, I said, remember that. Come over tomorrow and we'll do some research. So, and this is a kind of fun little vignette because he lived right above a deli. So he goes down to the deli and comes back with as many different beers from all parts of the world that he could find. And then we just started thinking the verses that would fit, you know, Sapporo and Pilsner Ukel and all that kind of thing. And he used it in the, you know, it was one of his stage pieces on, when he did that show live. And
that's
eventually
great.
Recorded it.
Very cool. Now, speaking of producers, I kind of skipped over this earlier, but that one records album that you're on was originally being produced by Mutt Lange, and he left, and then it was produced by Tim Freese Green, right?
That's right. But that was, that was always the arrangement. The arrangement was that Mutt would produce four tracks, and then he was off to work with AC/DC.
Yeah.
So you can't really say anything bad about his chops in that regard.
Yeah.
Very different sounding record to the album, but Tim I got along with. Tim I really liked. Tim was very musical and much more interested in the whole sound rather than just pumping up the vocals, I suppose you might say. But I liked Tim a lot, actually. He's a very nice man.
I love them both. Tim, especially because I'm a big Tok Tok fan. He, you know, very important in shaping the sound of Tok Tok. And I've tried to get him on here, but he told me he doesn't like to talk about the past, and so he won't let me interview him. But I am curious if you have stories about both of them. I mean, Mutt is this recluse, but has an ear like no one else in the business. What are your recollections of working with these two?
That Mutt was not very interested in working with us for very long.
Oh.
Tim, on the other hand, was really enjoying it, I think. So it was a little bit different in that respect.
Huh. Mutt
insisted on re-recording Starry Eyes, and my opinion was, why?
Yeah.
You know, we already did that one. We captured Lightning in the Bottle on that track, to use an expression.
Yeah.
And I think he was just looking for the glory in some respect. Mm. Well, he missed that on that. So then we did Rock and Roll Love Letter with him, and that was a complete failure. Somebody had come up with the idea of giving away a free EP with that album, and I basically got tasked with producing it, which is where I kind of learned to do that. And they needed a B-side for what was going to be Teenorama, so we'd sort of been playing the phone a little bit, but I basically completely reworked it, wrote a whole bunch of new lyrics to it, and we cut it in the same session, which I think was the beginning of the end.
right. Okay.
There was only really room for two songwriters in that band, and one of them wasn't me.
Yeah. So what's the magic then of Tim? I mean, you obviously have really good, really fond memories of working with him. I love his stuff. It's very diverse. I would never put you and Tok Tok in the same category at all, but he manages to master both. What's the magic of Tim Freese Green?
Well, he's a wonderful a musician. He's a great keyboard player, pianist, really. Mm-hmm. And he has a wicked sense of humor.
Mm.
So those things can work really well in a stage.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm curious.
He was very open to my suggestions. You know, he invited me to contribute. So,
Okay. I'm curious, do you remember, as you're working on that first records album, do you remember who else was in the neighboring studios? Who were you passing, like, in the bathroom and in the hallway and stuff while you're making that record? Anyone we'd know?
Peter Gabriel.
Really? Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay.
I think the Jam were around.
Nice.
Keith Levine walked into the studio one day and was really obnoxious. We were in a townhouse and then also in Wessex. But the Wessex was just, you know, the townhouse was a studio complex. Virgin had opened this place in West London.
Yeah.
Townhouse Wessex was an old church. It had a great sound to it, too. And that's where we did all the stuff with Tim.
Mm. Okay. Okay. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
You touched on this earlier, kind of jumping ship from David to Graham Parker. Again, how does this happen? I like Graham Parker a lot. And I really like the Steady Nerves album that you're on. I had William Whitman on here who produced that album.
Right.
It features probably my favorite Graham Parker song, Wake Up Next to You. I love that. How did this pairing come to be?
Oh, I met Graham, who was managed by Dave Robinson, who owned Stiff Records at the time. And Graham came up one night to a gig and sat in and sang lead vocals with Rachel Sweet. And I just sat with him in a quiet room in the theater that we were playing in and showed him the song, basically. And he had called me not long after I moved to New York, and he wanted me to go. You know, we were just sort of like feeling each other out a little bit. And I see him in Canada with David, and he calls me up and says, you know, the guy that he had in the band wasn't working out, and was I available to do a tour starting tomorrow? And I was saying, like, Graham, I'm in Toronto.
Right.
And there's a few more gigs to do, so I'm going to have to say no. But about a year or so later, and offered me the job. And by that point, I was ready for change, actually. So
yeah.
I did it. I thought it would lead to much more of a recording experience with him. But I don't know what he was. I think he was a bit burnt out at that point. He didn't want to do so much touring. This is a guy, by the way, who turned down Live Aid.
Good point. Yeah, good point. Yeah.
He wanted a day off.
Wow.
The career really on if you've done it, I think.
Yeah.
So, that was that.
Okay, so that's the end of that partnership. But are these... Yeah. I meant to ask you this when we were talking about David. David, I mean, from an outsider's perspective, seems to have a very big personality as well. I saw one of the New York Dolls reunion gigs probably 10 years ago or something like that. And kind of a legend in his own way. What was he like to work with? Do you have any stories? Was it fun? Was it chaotic? Was it dramatic? Was it unpleasant, or was it pleasant? What's it like working with David Johansen, of all people?
Mostly it was really nice.
Okay.
Really nice. Yeah, I love David. He's a great guy. He was kind of like my big brother when I first came to New York. He kind of showed me around a little bit, took me under his wing, sort of. And I mean, I'm a couple of years younger than him, but I'm fresh off, you know, I'm fresh off the boat, really. I've toured over here, but I'm not really familiar with the New York that he grew up in. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So for some time there, we used to room together on tour and so forth, write songs together. And,
wild. Do a lot of drugs together?
No, not really. Well, I think we smoked some weed probably, but sure. David's main drug of choice was alcohol by that point. I think there was, previous, again, I don't want to gossip about that because I really don't know,
sure.
but
okay.
I mean, we know what happened to Jerry Nolan and Johnny Thunders.
Right. So. That's why I mentioned it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I think there might have been, I think more than one of them might have been using for a while, but he clean when I met him,
Okay.
A lot of reformed junkies do tend to go to alcohol, mentioring no names, Keith Richards. One of the other crutches, I suppose.
I'm just
pontificating here, so that's between you and me.
Sure, of course.
But generally with David, until what was happening was that his management, I thought, was just really trying to squeeze money out of, because after we'd done the Live It Up tour, there was no follow-up, so there was nothing really for them to hang it on, so they were still hanging his rep on that record. A couple of good, one of the good guys in the band had moved on and became a little bit not as good as it had been, something like that.
Okay.
But still, I'm still in touch with a couple of people who are in the band, one of them in particular.
Good.
That brings us up to, so then I could record Guitarophilia while I'm still with David, and it comes out while I'm with Graham, and I'm not sure that went over particularly well either, because you can't necessarily, if you're Graham Parker, you don't have somebody in the band that wants to sing his own songs.
Good point.
A Graham Parker show, what I mean?
Fair
enough. But I'm not I was ever trying to do anything like that, but it's a very insecure business back in those days. And if you could possibly posed an imagined threat, then maybe you weren't the guy, or the manager would be saying, you can't have him. He's trying to do, he's going to be, trying to sell his stuff off of your back, whatever, which I really wasn't trying to do at all.
Sure.
I was quite surprised when it came out sounding as good as it did, to be honest with you.
Okay. Yeah, I can imagine that. If I'm the leader of my band and my new guitarist is putting out solo albums on the side, I might get a little nervous, I guess, back then anyway.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Okay.
I mean, it depends who you are, I suppose. Some people are totally okay about it, right? Others are not, I suppose.
Yeah. Now, we skipped over a couple people that I wanted to ask you about specifically. One in particular is Carlene Carter, because that's... I mean, she's a country artist, and it seems to me, if I'm doing my chronology correctly, you go from the records basically to Carlene, or thereabouts. And I'm wondering what that had to have been a real shift for you to go from playing these power pop chords to going into a country vein. You touched on the music that you liked and that influenced you, and a lot of it, like I said, is American, even down to the Grateful Dead and stuff like that. These are not hallmarks of most young British kids that I talk to anyway. And so I'm curious if country was it a big shift for you or maybe not?
Well, John, the only reason I really did very little bit of recording with Colleen, nothing else, was I was making some tracks with a guy, his name Brian Copsey, I think his name was, and we were in a studio being recorded by Stuart Coleman. And it was the place where Nick Lowe was making his records at that point.
Oh, nice.
And so I'm about to leave the studio. I've done my session. I think I finished right around 6 o'clock. And in walks Nick and Carlene. I knew a couple of the guys in the band, Bobby Irwin. We were pretty good pals then. And they had an argument, I believe, with Billy Bremner the night before. He had refused to show up at the studio. So they needed a guitar player. So it had to be in the right place at the right time.
I see.
I played guitar on one track, and they brought me back in to do a couple of backing vocals, and that was basically it, actually. I would have quite liked to have worked with them, but...
I get it. Do you remember what song it was that you played guitar on?
Yes, it was called That Boy.
That Boy, okay. Yeah, I saw that on your...
If you happen to use the Guitarophilia stuff, I remastered and reissued that last year.
Yeah.
So it's out on CD now, so if you want to try and troll around for that. It's on CD Baby, I think.
Good. Yeah, I noticed there's an expanded... Right, there's an expanded version on Spotify with all this other stuff on it that is also fantastic. Right. Yeah. And then the other one I want to ask you about is Rachel Sweet, because she's actually somebody that I get a lot of requests for Rachel on the show because she's kind of disappeared and I can't find her anywhere. And I don't know what her story is. I don't know if she's okay, but I wonder if maybe she was a little bit of a delicate flower or a little bit of a brittle personality or what the deal was back then. What was it like working with Rachel Sweet?
She was very good. I mean, she was 16-year-old, so her voice was, you know, young, obviously.
Yeah, true.
But I did do a bit of work with her after that. She was making a movie for a while, which I don't think ever came out. I did a session one day for a song on that. I never saw the light of day. I heard that she was in, she made 3 records for Epic, I think, and then stopped doing it. She did something that she never wants to talk about. I've seen a couple of interviews regarding, I think, a talking doll. Again, this is maybe the rumor mill, but I heard that she was an early investor in Comedy Central.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and just perhaps put it in some perspective, Madonna bought her Bel Air Mansion off Rachel for $8 million some years
ago.
So, yeah, well, I mean, you might want to corroborate that before.
Well, I'll look it up. You know? That is fantastic trivia right there. I had no idea.
Right. But,
okay.
Yeah, I know this. You know, people do like Rachel. And Out There Somewhere is a BBC broadcast that we did with Rachel Sweet and the Records, which actually is very good. Which I had a link to that on my 2 computers ago.
Yeah, right. Okay.
From what I heard, that was like she just, you know, she doesn't want to be in the music business, and I think it's had enough of it. So.
Okay. Similarly, if we were to play a song that summarizes your partnership with Rachel, what song should we play?
Oh shoot! Well, we wrote one together, though we didn't get credit for it. The plan was that everybody on the Stiff tour had to record a version of Be Stiff by Devo.
Ah.
Rachel and I got together on a Saturday afternoon with Northern Ireland at the time and knocked out the version of Be Stiff that's actually on her greatest hits record, believe it or not, but it's credited to Mark Mothersbaugh, I guess, or whoever in Devo wrote it.
Yeah.
But we basically, apart from taking the chorus, she wrote the lyrics and I just helped with the chords. I don't think I saw any lyric ideas in there at all.
Okay.
So it's that one. I mean, I think I recorded one of the songs for the second album, but I can't remember what it's called.
Okay.
Take Good Care of Me, that's right. Yeah, I did the guitar solo on that.
Okay.
Why don't you want to go outside at night? You're so excitable, you get so uptight. Don't you want to be safe protecting me? I always thought I could rely on you. You were so quick to show me what to do. Would you rather impress somebody new? All I want is for you to take good care of me. I can look after you, that's the way you want it to be. But all I want is for you to take good care of me. You treat me like I'm so dispensable. Don't seem to know that I need more than love. Don't you wanna make sure I don't run away? You used to show me off to all your friends, but now you leave me on my own again. If fashion wasn't fashion, I know that you'd never stay. All I want is for you to take good care of me. I can look after you, that's the way you want it to be. But all I want is for you to take good care of me.
I'm writing these.
My memory's quite good, actually.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
I remember more than a lot. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I remember a lot more than I realized.
Okay.
So but I mean, we're talking still, you know, we're still in the 70s and the early 80s at this point.
Right.
Johansson, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, now, speaking of which, after all this stuff kind of comes to an end, I mean, where do you go from there? What do you do today, Hugh? I've listened to your solo albums, In Pursuit of Excellence and Ile de France, mm-hmm. I'm probably supposed to say it with an accent. And they're both fantastic, but they're so, it's sporadic, you know? So what does Hugh Gower do today to, you know, pay his bills or stay in music? What do you do?
Okay, so let me think about it. I don't answer that. There are two other, basically, well, more or less all original material albums out there, but Ice Cream Skyscraper.
Okay.
That gives you some idea of what I was doing in this decade, because I think I did one of those in 2011, 2012, and the other one in 2017.
Oh.
But for the last nearly 30 years, I've also been teaching music in schools to little kids.
Oh, wow. Okay, very nice.
After I start doing it, this is not a bad way to start to grow old gracefully and still make a living out of playing music. So it's effectively what I did. So about 1989 onwards, I've been doing it consistently since then. At one point, I was working at a lot of different New York schools. Now it's just one or two. I also did a lot of club dates working with bands that did songs by the Drifters or the Platters or those kind of oldies acts, is what you call them. Of course, all the audience is dead. All the audience of that sort of is dead now. So.
Or
doesn't go out anymore. Like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I
to be honest with you, John, by the time the middle of the 80s came around, I thought that two things happened that killed the music. One was Madonna and the other was MTV. Mm. And they, of course, they were made for each other. But at that point, I'm 33. I'm a father. And it doesn't seem quite so imperative that I follow it along so much. Yeah. I did have a couple of bands. I mean, I was in a band called Magic Muscle back in the 70s.
Oh.
And we reformed and made a record called 100 Miles Below, which was, came out in 89.
Up and I'm alone. I'm all mixed up, you know. The dream is gone. Wood carved a man. You are my friend. Yes, you are. You carved your another day, the wind has blown the light away, and night will bring the peaceful rain.
And I produced that, and it's a live album with a little bit of help, and that was fun, but I was in New York and everybody else was living in England, so it wasn't really going to be a long-term relationship.
Okay.
So, okay. I've done projects like that, but I also got to the point where I just wanted to do my own thing. So I found myself becoming a bit more prolific. And so I was able to write Ile de France. And, I got inspired again and wrote In Pursuit of Excellence. Yeah.
They're both great.
Thanks.
All right. Well, then, you've had this long and varied career and worked with some Luminaries and your own music is fantastic. When you look back at all of this, what are some of the favorite memories that come to mind? When you're, is it playing a particularly good show or hearing yourself on the radio or a favorite groupie or a favorite spot on the road that has the best burgers in town? Or what's your favorite thing when you look back on all of this?
Possibly just discovering Japanese food for the first time. That was
really?
Pretty big. Still love it.
Why? What about Japanese food?
Because I'd never had it before. The idea of eating raw fish to me as a Brit, it's like the fish and chips or whatever. Like,
true.
What?
True.
And then I tried it and went, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
So, my wife and I now have Japanese. Well, unfortunately, right now we can't because all the restaurants are closed, but it's just a regular twice a month thing for us to get some sushi or whatever. I don't know. I mean, I might have to come back to you on a couple of points with that. I mean, I never met the Queen or anything like that. I'm happier now than I've ever been before in many respects, even though I'm, not a young kid anymore. Some of it was so exciting just doing it. I think I remember when we were on the Stiff Tour, I started asking us all, you have a part, this is in Britain, and this is, they rented this train for us to, which that's a memory. That's the best tour I've ever done. That was fantastic, Yeah, it was really great. So they're asking us all, do you have a passport? No. Well, you need to get one. Why? We can't tell you. Oh, come on. And so that, they were organizing 40 musicians to go to play in New York. And so that was, first time in New York was pretty amazing.
Nice. Very nice. And you live in New York City still?
Yeah. Since 81, actually.
Wow. Good for you. Well,
hey, forget about it.
Now you sound like a New Yorker. That's great. Well, thanks Hugh for talking with me. I really like the records and I like the sound, the solo stuff you've done probably even better, to be honest, but I just was curious what your story might be and who you've worked with and who you are. And so I'm really grateful that you talked to me. Thanks for sharing your story with me.
You're very welcome, and I appreciate that you've listened to some of the other stuff, because, it's obviously, you can't stay in the past, and the Ice Cream Skyscraper CDs, I think, are worth checking out as well.
Okay. I didn't know about those. Spotify, whatever. You need a website or something, Hugh. I couldn't find one, so it was...
There isn't one.
Yeah, so it was kind of hard to find deeper information like that about you, and so I'll check it out for sure. I didn't even know it was out there. So,
well, I will say one thing about to categorize myself in not a good way. I am probably the world's worst self promoter these days. I'm just not very good at this. And it was easy when you're young, just looking for jobs and looking for gigs, because you've got all that testosterone that's gene you up, whatever you want to call it, natural energy. And I don't want to sound like I'm an old fart right now, but I am older. I'm right now, these online classes I'm doing with my little ones, it's great. It's like being on. Now I know what it's like to be, doing something in a TV studio on a regular basis. And after you finish a song, nothing happens.
right.
So you just have to keep moving on. It's fine. I'm really enjoying it. And my wife's helping me a lot to do some of the, we're using puppets and extra instruments. And it's kind of cool because I would just go to schools with my acoustic guitar, maybe a recorder. Now I can use a 12-string and I use an order harp, and we're using percussion and so forth. So it's more like a show now than just an informal sort of sitting into a classroom kind of situation. And these are very young children. They're preschoolers now. I've worked with older elementary school kids as well, and that was a bit more sophisticated because by virtue of the fact that they're 8 or 9 or 10 years old. But it keeps you young, actually.
I bet.
It keeps you young.
I bet. That's got to be nice. Well, cool. Well, thank you, Hugh. All right, there you have it, Hugh Gower. Hope that was okay. Seriously, though, the whole time you're listening to that conversation, would you have ever guessed that the guy you're listening to teaches music to young, like kindergarten-age children? I would never have guessed that. It's fascinating to me. I want to close it out with another solo song of his. This is off that Guitarophilia album, French Girls. I love this song. I love everything he's done, mostly the solo work. No offense, records fans, but I like his solo work better. Anyway, next week is our 300th episode. And so we have a special guest lined up for our 300th episode. And we hope, as always, you will join us next week to find out who that is. It is somebody who I've mentioned before that this person was coming up as a guest, but maybe you didn't piece that together. It's someone who has come up in conversation a few times in the past with other guests. Okay? Little teasers there. Also, hopefully you listened to our year in review. Also, hopefully if you don't already follow or haven't seen the Permanent Record podcast, I was very honored to be brought back on there. I love those guys. The Linens are so nice. And they brought me and David O of the D-Side podcast, which is largely a Duran Duran podcast, to talk about David Bowie. And the first installment is us basically counting down our top five albums. And then the next installment is going to be our top five favorite songs. So anyway, check out Permanent Record if you want. And as always, you know, Patreon, Amazon, buy a t-shirt. You can find us on Facebook, like our page, send us a message on there. You can send us an email at thehustlepod@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter at thehustlepod. And a huge thanks, huge shout out to my right-hand man, Jan Matkiewicz. Because Jan the man is the one who takes things like this and fixes them so that they sound great for you. So give him a big hug next time you see him, okay? Thanks, everybody. We love you.